In our fifth lecture, we are now going to continue with the mystical approach. We've already explained that, according to this way of thinking, we do not focus on how mitzvah affects the individual, but rather we focus on the cosmic effect of one's actions on mankind in general and on the universe as a whole. To use the author's terminology, we are looking for their effect on macrocosm and microcosm alike. We are actually going to do this in a somewhat circuitous manner and in a real methodological manner, neither of which I associate really with any sort of mystical approach. And to tell you the truth, I have my doubts if this is really the mystical approach. However, since I don't know anything about it, I'm not initiated in any of this. I'm mostly summarizing Diane Grunfeld's words, and this is the approach he takes, and this is what we're going to see. The Torah tells us that consuming prohibited meat has a bad effect on a person, as we quoted earlier. On the other hand, we are supposed to keep the dietary laws as a positive for man, meaning by avoiding certain deleterious items and making those part of our being, it allows us, it makes it easier for us to work on ourselves. It's not abstinence itself which is the goal. It's rather the avoidance of these items that the Torah deems debasing and defiling to the human body that would interfere with our goal. The Torah tells us in Vayikra Perek Chaf, Psukim Chaf He through Chaf Vav, says, V'hivdaltem bein ha-behema tehora la temeya, uvein ha-of ha-temey la tehor, v'lusi shakatsu es nafshu sichem ba-behema uva-of, v'chol asher tirmos ha-adoma, asher hivdalti lachem l'tamey, v'yisem li kidoshim ki kadosh ani Hashem, v'avdil eschem in ho-amim li'yos li. And this translates as, you shall therefore separate between the clean beast and the unclean, and between the unclean fowl and the clean, and you shall not make your souls detestable by beast or by fowl, which I have set apart for you to hold unclean. And you shall be holy unto me, for I, the Lord, am holy, and have set you apart from the peoples, that you should be mine. We see clearly from these psukim, and from other psukim as well, that the purpose of the dietary laws has nothing to do with hygiene. Although that might, perhaps, be a benefit of kashrus, it's most surely not the reason for the dietary laws. Based on the verses quoted, we see that the dietary laws do not focus on the human body per se, but rather on the unity of the body and the soul. This is a fundamental concept of Judaism. We always seek to be one complete whole being to the best of our ability. We are always a Jew through and through, and kashrus is the same. We are concerned for the unity between the physical and the spiritual. Now, in order to find a compelling reason that could explain the dietary laws, we need to examine what the Torah tells us. The word used many times in the Torah to describe prohibited animals is the word tame. It is essential that we have a clear meaning of this word, and the closest we can express the concept of tame in English is with the word impure. Tame is always used in a moral or a metaphysical sense. It is never used in terms of the physical. There are two types of tuma as well. One is in the moral realm, and this is the antithesis of kedusha, and this type of tuma is a concrete sort of tuma. And the other is metaphysical, and its opposite is tahara, and this sort of tuma is more symbolical. The concrete tuma includes items that directly affect man, such as the dietary laws and the laws of forbidden relationships and such. The symbolical tuma, at first glance, does not seem to be connected to man as much as it is connected to items that need to be excluded from the sanctuary. Some animals even belong to both types of tuma. They are forbidden to eat, and therefore they have concrete tuma, and at the same time, the carcasses of certain animals give off symbolical tuma, as for example a dead sheretz. Since we see that both types of tuma meet each other in the realm of kashrus, it is of paramount importance to understand tuma in order to understand any deeper meaning of kashrus. In order to get a good handle on tuma, let's analyze one of the more serious types of tuma called av hatuma through the approach of Rav Hirsch. We have stated that moral freedom is central to Judaism. Man, as we know, is made up of a combination of body and soul. The body seems to be subjected to nature on every level. However, despite the fact that we are subjected to nature, man, the combination of body and soul, is morally free. And this religious axiom and philosophical postulate is really beyond human understanding. Judaism and all positive religions are based on this postulate of freedom of will. Anything that weakens man's conviction in moral freedom, it destroys man's inner harmony between his physical side and his soul. When it comes to teaching, it is essential to counteract any idea that would lead one to believe that man is not morally free. The result of this line of thinking is that man is a slave to the physical, to necessity, to the soil where he comes from. The absolute most clear sign of this line of thinking is epitomized in a dead body. It shows, above all else, that man is fully subjected to the laws of nature as he succumbs to it, and as a result, he lacks moral freedom. Meaning, he can't do what he wants. He has to do what his body wants. Whatever makes you feel good, just like any other animal, whatever your instinct is what you need to do. However, Judaism teaches us that, and here's an exact quote, what is eternal in man belongs to the realm of the divine and is free and has long left the dead body. In other words, when the body becomes subjected to the forces of decay, the immortal aspect of man, his soul, when it was connected to the body, it lifts up the body into the sphere of moral freedom. Now, as a side point, this is why, or at least one of the reasons why, we treat the body both during life and after life with such care. The body serves the divine and the immortal aspect of man, and as such, the body is an instrument that's holy. It's an instrument that we use, that God gave us, an instrument of God. It is the instrument through which we are able to express our moral autonomy and our freedom. So coming back to this dead body, it is tame. It epitomizes tuma. This means that it has the ability to cloud the truth of man's moral freedom, of his freedom of will. One who is tame may not enter the mikdash. And the mikdash is the place that teaches that through the divine presence and the law, man is morally free. As a result of the tumah, he must go through a process that redirects him away from this dangerous idea of tumah. Once he goes through this process, he is once again aware that he is a free person and is capable of self-sanctification. And this all represents symbolical tumah. Let us now examine the concrete tumah that results from eating forbidden food. The Torah uses two terms in relation to forbidden animals, tame and sheketz. Sheketz being an intensified form of tame. The Torah uses these two terms in many other contexts, such as idol worship and immorality, specifically in terms of incest. We are assured by the Torah, through the use of the very same words, that consuming these forbidden foods has the same negative effect on the body, on a person's soul and moral character, as that of immoral actions. So the question is, how can we explain that food influences man in terms of his body and in terms of his soul as well? And the truth is, we discussed this in Lecture 3, where we mentioned that New York Times article, but let's try to follow Tyne Grunfeld's explanation here. Philosophers disagree on the relationship between the body and the soul, and in terms of metaphysics, the matter is also really inexplicable. As far as physiology, so we really discussed this already, it's very easy to relate to. We know that food affects one's mind and character. From drugs such as alcohol to regular everyday food, we know that these affect one's body physically and also a person's mental state. To quote directly, the dietetics of the mind and the dietetics of the soul are closely related. Now, you'll notice that we are understanding one's mental makeup as a representation of the soul. But either way, Diane Grunfeld states that many Jews who do not keep the dietary laws, they like to say that as an excuse, it is not what comes into the mouth of man that defiles him, but what comes out of it. And we can clearly see from a physiological perspective that this is false. Now, turning to religion, the manner that food affects man spiritually is much simpler. God created man and his mind, and he knows what is beneficial for us and what is harmful. The Torah tells us that certain foods have a deleterious effect on man, and our knowledge of the relationship between the body and the soul is severely limited. Furthermore, the dietary laws are a chok. They're a mitzvah where we cannot fully figure out why we are commanded to do it, although we keep it nonetheless, and we offer reasons for it nonetheless. Now, after this long introduction, let us focus on the one mystical source that's quoted in the book, although there are other sources that are listed in the footnote. But he goes with Ricanti, and Ricanti explains that since the soul can only operate through the body, it is essential that the body remains a servant to the soul and not to its own passions. Just like, he says, a craftsman needs proper and exacting tools to perform his work, the soul as well needs the body to perform its task, and therefore the body works best with fine material rather than with coarse material. And he gives a mashal, he says it's similar to a lamp that has a clear glass as opposed to a lamp which has an opaque glass, or to a plant which is planted in optimal soil, how well it's going to grow, as opposed to one planted in poor quality soil. Food that the Torah forbids makes the body a coarse instrument and awakens the animalistic side of man. And this is what is termed Kabbalistically as Timtum Halev. And to give an exact quote, Ricanti ends by saying, "With all the dietary laws, it says, 'Be holy to me,' in order to purify the soul which draws its sustenance from the food in accordance with its refinement and purity." This ends our discussion regarding the mystical, metaphysical, physiological approaches to how the soul works through the body. And it seems in some ways that we missed the mark, because we never explained how this affects the cosmos, but really how it affects the individual and his body in relation to his soul. I would say that anyone who would like to learn more about this, you should see it inside. It's a lot more detailed. There are lots of sources, and you could look it up. And next time we will hopefully examine the symbolical approach, which will be a little easier to understand.